From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, our Writers Week continues, featuring some of our favorite interviews with writers from our archives. Today, Richard Price, best known for his novel Clockers, talks about growing up Jewish in the Bronx when he wanted to be everything that he wasn't, like Italian, or a gang member, or James Brown. Tobias Wolff, author of This Boy's Life, talks about his coming of age when his parents split up and his mother took him on the road to start a new life. Performance poet Sekou Sundiata reads a poem about Harlem, where he grew up. And Jane Rule describes the reaction to her first lesbian novel, Desert of the Heart, published in 1964. Writers Week continues on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Seattle Mayor Paul Schell has canceled plans for the city's New Year's Eve celebration, saying he doesn't want to take chances with the public safety because of the possibility of terrorism. Seattle has been shaken recently by the arrest of a man accused of smuggling explosives into Washington state and by violence during the protests against the World Trade Organization. About 50,000 people had been expected to gather in a park beneath the city's landmark Space Needle to celebrate the new year. The hijackers of an Indian airliner have stepped up their demands. They're now demanding that the Indian government give them $200 million in cash and release 35 Kashmiri militants. They're also demanding the release of a Pakistani religious leader being held in an Indian jail. The hijackers are holding more than 150 hostages at an airport in Afghanistan. Veer Singh in New Delhi reports the Indian government is being pressured to both give in and stand firm.
If the Indian government were to release the Muslim cleric, it would be a huge concession and a big political price would have to be paid. This person is associated with an entire movement that advocated militancy against Indian rule in the northern province of Kashmir. So there's a lot of pressure on the government to continue its stand, not to give in to their demands. Having said that, the Indian public has seen the cremation of the only known victim of the hijacking. This has sent tempers flaring. There have been severe criticism in the press of the Indian government's apparent hesitation for the first 3 days to do anything.
Veer Singh in New Delhi. The U.S. has suspended economic assistance to Ivory Coast because of last week's military takeover in the West African nation. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
State Department spokesman Philip Reeker said the United States strongly condemns the forceful ouster of the elected government in Ivory Coast. In a written statement, Reeker said Washington will immediately suspend bilateral assistance and all arms transfers to the country. In addition, the United States will reconsider its support for Ivory Coast in international financial institutions. But the State Department is also encouraged, Reeker said, by indications that order is being restored in the capital, Abidjan. He called on authorities to ensure the safety of everyone there, and he said there should be no reprisals against members of the ousted government. This was Ivory Coast's first coup in nearly four decades of independence. Ted Clark, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 85 points to close at a record 11,476. This is NPR News. About 1,000 firefighters are battling a 700-acre wildfire that threatens houses in two suburbs of Los Angeles. People in downtown Los Angeles can see the smoke from the fire to the east of the city. More than 100 people have left their homes as a precaution, but fire officials say calmer winds are helping them bring the fire under control before it reaches any houses. Minnesota Public Radio is being sued by that state's attorney general for allegedly breaking the laws governing charities by exchanging lists of its donors with other groups, including the Democratic National Committee. NPR's Brooke Gladstone reports.
Minnesota Attorney General Mike Hatch is seeking civil penalties against the public radio network because, he says, it shared its donor list with some 100 organizations, sometimes including the phone numbers of members. The suit says that members of Minnesota Public Radio were not sufficiently informed of how their names would be used, a lapse which violates state laws. The network responded in a statement saying that it had informed its members that their names might be used occasionally in compliance with the law, and that the Attorney General's suit appears to turn principally on the meaning of the word occasional. The network says that amounts to about 6 times a year over the past 5 years. Minnesota Public Radio also said it offered donors the opportunity to withdraw their names if they wished. Brooke Gladstone, NPR News.
A retail industry group says sales rose strongly over the Christmas holiday. The International Council of Shopping Centers says sales were nearly 8% higher than during the same period last year. The group said 1.2 billion shoppers visited malls across the country between Thanksgiving and New Year's. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This is Writers Week on Fresh Air, featuring some of our favorite interviews with writers from our archive. Richard Price is not only a terrific writer, he's one of the best talkers I've ever heard. He's been a frequent guest on Fresh Air. We're going to listen back to our 1986 interview. Price is the author of several novels which have been adapted into films, including Clockers, The Wanderers, and Blood Brothers. He wrote the screenplays for The Color of Money, Sea of Love, Ransom, and Mad Dog and Glory. His work has been inspired by movies, TV, and rock and roll, as well as literature. Price's early novels were about young men who have reached a dead end in their lives, a dead end that threatens to trap them forever unless they find a way out. His characters were products of lower middle class, multi-ethnic neighborhoods in the Bronx. Our interview began with a reading from his 1984 novel, The Breaks. The novel opens at the college graduation of the main character, Peter Keller. Out-of-town college got him away from his family and out of the Bronx, but when his plans for law school are scrapped, he's back home in the neighborhood looking for a way out.
The entire month of June was siesta hot. The weather combined with my home again emotional jet lag to give me a psychosomatic case of tired blood. After spending the morning staggering around for a job or shaking hands with my father, I had to fight off the desire to go back up to Yonkers and take a nap. If I was too beat to track down leads in the afternoons, I'd duck into movies or museums. I knew that in my mental state, naps could kill. At nights, the three of us would sit in the living room, watch Cannon, the Mod Squad, ABC's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday night at the movies, the news, Johnny Carson, and Crash. I didn't watch too much television in college, but when I did, it was with a loud crowd around the dorm lounge, the fraternity lounge, or in my senior year garden apartment with Bam Bam and some dates or neighbors. Whatever we watched in those 4 years was secondary to the wisecracks, the eating, and the grass. TV nights with my father and Vi is Peter's stepmother, were silent affairs. At first, I tried to drum up some group hysteria, frantically insulting Cannon's fatness or Chester's limp on the Gunsmoke reruns. But the best I could score were some polite chuckles from my father. Vi wouldn't know a funny line if it bit her on the ass. I had never seen her laugh in my life. One night toward the end of June on NYPD, we saw a cop come across his partner lying in a pool of blood with what looked like a cannonball wound in his gut. The cop bent down and said, "Are you okay?" And I exploded with a half dozen responses in 10 seconds. My father missed the wounded cop's answer because of my floor show, and wincing in irritation, asked Vi what the guy had said. Vi quoted it back verbatim, and An Evening with Pete Keller closed out of town forever. The next morning, I woke up and realized I had two choices, either get on the stick and land some kind of job that would make me feel like a human being, or wind up as the subject of an article in the American Journal for the Study of Mass Murderers. I covered the kitchen table with the want ad sections of every newspaper I could find and started making calls. I answered one ad for someone who desired to break into the magazine world, but after a 20-minute failed conversation with a woman who described herself as personnel master, I figured out that the position was for a boy Friday in the office of a small, erratically published dominatrix journal. The second call went better. There was an ad in the Village Voice requesting verbally aggressive people. I got a Mrs. Himmel on the line and found out I had reached a phone soliciting outfit called American Communicators. Mrs. Himmel sounded cool and regal with a slight trace of the Danube in her voice. She seemed relaxed and intelligent, so I took a chance and told her I had a college degree. She cooed with approval, and that spurred me on to reveal that I had graduated from the Harvard of upstate New York. Honors in English, how's that for verbal? It was my first interview where the extent of my education didn't do me in, and laying out my resume for Mrs. Himmel made me feel like Clark Kent slowly unbuttoning his white shirt. I don't know if it was her leisurely curiosity or just my hunger for a real conversation, but it turned out to be the best talk I'd had since college. I wanted to give her my life story, the tears, the fears, the laughs. I totally forgot it was a job interview, and I wound up running down every accomplishment since kindergarten except for winning the Triple Crown and Punch Bowl for the 1957 season. She requested my presence for an orientation meeting the next day, and I hung up so excited that I walked around the house for a half hour absently clapping my hands.
And that's a selection from Richard Price's The Breaks. The character in The Breaks is the first character, main character, in any of your novels to have actually finished college. Most of your novels are about characters who come out of working class, lower middle class neighborhoods in the Bronx. Were there a lot of writers writing about those kinds of neighborhoods when your first novel was published?
Well, if there were, the novel might never have gotten published. This is something that I usually say about that the whole situation of me trying to be a writer in that kind of environment. I mean, I don't want to romanticize the poverty or something. It was basically, you know, working-class neighborhood. What happens, though, in a working-class neighborhood is that the parents are children of people that try to scratch livings out of the Depression. So my parents were kids during the Depression, haunted by economic survival. And if it was in the 60s, and you were the first kid in that family to go to college, and you wanted to do something in which there was no blue chip guarantee of a professional job at the end of the education, they thought you were nuts. So the brightest minds of my housing project and millions of housing projects like that across America, I would guess, would go to engineering school or medical school because there was a job. If you were going to Cornell like I did and your father's putting the money together for you to go, and you want to be something like a poet or a painter or a dancer, they would look at you like you were mentally defective and you were wasting their money. So it was very hard for a kid to get the validation to do something creative. Myself, I was so psyched out by that thinking that even though I wanted to be a writer, I got a degree in labor relations.
Just so you could
just because I didn't
do the
feel
right
like
thing.
Well, I thought, well, gee, maybe writing could be a hobby, you know, and then it sort of took over. When I was in college.
It seems important for all of your characters to get out of the neighborhood and to break away from the family, but it's really difficult for most of them to achieve that. Mm. Were you in that kind of situation? Was it hard for you to get out? Was college your ticket out?
I used to think it was just a matter of like getting away from the family or some doctrinaire attitude about, you know, the politics of, you know, family smothering children or economic survival. I think it's more like this general feeling I had all my life, which I think a lot of people have, which is, where is it? You know, it's like you're looking for it and you're trying to escape something because what you're doing now, there's an old Lord Buckley routine where there's a conquistador. Lord Buckley was a jazz comic in the early 50s, and he had a routine about Cabeza de Vaca, which a conquistador was looking for India, wound up in St. Petersburg, Florida. And what he said to his troops is, we didn't know where we was, but we knew where we was wasn't it. And I think what I've been writing about is that feeling of like escape. It's not the family, it's not the economics, it's something intangible. And I used to think it was something tangible, like economics or family, but it's that feeling of like, I still feel it, no matter what you have, you're over here, but it's over there. And the minute you're over there, it's over here. You know, and it's that zip-zip roadrunner game that you play with something that you can't get a hold of that I think I've been writing about all along.
But it's interesting, once you got out of the Bronx and you actually started writing, what you were writing about was the thing that you left, which was the Bronx and family.
Well, that's the only way. I mean, what else can you write about? I used to teach writing, and I don't think you can write about anything if it's if you're surrounded by it, because you can't see the forest for the trees, to use a cliche. When I went away to college, my life changed so radically. And I knew I was never going to go back. And it was something in my life finally that had the end. attached to it, which a lot of young writers don't have because there's not that much that has finished in their life. And I had gone, after Cornell, I'd gone to Stanford, which I'd never been out of New York State in my life. And I knew whether I liked the Bronx or didn't like the Bronx, it was over. It was a part of my life that was over. And it would only exist as long as I could remember it. And it had nothing to do whether it was good or bad. It was just a part of my life that was finished. And out of that panic of losing a part of my life, I forced it to crystallize, you know, to write it down just before it escaped, you know, and I got senile or something.
Once you left the Bronx and you were with other people who weren't from the Bronx, did you start mythologizing that into something maybe larger than it was or different from what it was?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was sort of mythologized at more than me self-promoting the fact that I was Bruce Springsteen or Lou Reed or something like that. I mean, I think what happened is that basically I was a Jewish working class kid and I wrote about Italian kids because I had felt sort of psyched out because I felt, what could I say after Philip Roth or after Michael Gold or somebody like that? So I thought, and I knew, you know, I grew up in a housing project which was pretty eclectic and its collection of people is truly integrated. So I, you know, I was rubbing elbows with everybody, so it was just as easy for me to write about Italians. But what happened is when the book came out, I became the first person since James Farrell wrote Studs Lonergan or Hubert Selby wrote Last Exit to Brooklyn to get down into grits and the depth and everything. So everybody assumed that I graduated from Odyssey House as opposed to college, or, you know, I write with a switchblade, you know, and people were like scared of me. And it got to the point where they were kind of disappointed that I wasn't even Catholic, you know. I mean, people sort of wanted me to be this guy who wrote with his femur, you know, dipped in his victim's blood or something, you know, and I got kind of caught up in that, you know, because it's like I was 24 at the time and, you know, you don't know whether to go to the bathroom or wind your watch half the time when you're 24 and you're getting all this stuff thrown at you and you're getting, you know, you have a hard time knowing who you are, let alone getting this romanticized media thing thrown at you about yourself, and you start buying your own copy after a while. So then I started lying. I told people I was formerly Catholic, or, you know, I went to a different high school than I really did. You know, I went to DeWitt Clinton instead of Bronx High School of Science or something. But
did you develop a thicker accent?
Well, that happened not from writing The Wanderers. That happened because when I went away to Cornell up in Ithaca, New York, I felt so threatened by all these people who had real, like, Midwestern accents. If they came from Peru or Indiana, it was equally exotic to me because I had never met anybody outside. I thought the whole world was Italians, blacks, Jews, and Catholics. I never met a white Protestant person in my life before. And I felt very threatened by everybody else's sort of exoticism. So I think as a matter of survival, I sort of intensified my own exoticism, and you know, I developed a worse Bronx accent in Ithaca, New York than I ever had in the Bronx because I never needed it before.
We're listening to a 1986 interview with novelist and screenwriter Richard Price. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1986 interview with novelist and screenwriter Richard Price. His first novel, The Wanderers, was about street gangs in the Bronx. Were you ever in a gang? Did you have friends in gangs?
There's a comedian that I forgot the guy's name. I think it was, well, I don't know what his name is, but he had this thing that he was in the Goldberg gang. And I said it was no real big deal. We'd walk down the street and somebody would say, hey, here comes the Goldberg gang. And somebody else would say, big deal, what are they going to do, algebra? You know, that was kind of, you know, I mean, like I said, you know, I rubbed elbows with, like, tougher kids, you know, and nobody ever wants to be who they are. Everybody's, you know, kids want to be, like, athletes or, you know, like a Jewish kid wants to be James Brown. It's like, tell me I'm not who I am. Tell me there's something else out there.
What I figure you probably were, though, was the comedian and the writer.
I was like class clown, you know, and yeah, I was, you know, well, what happens is like when you're 13 years old and it's like, you know, you can't tolerate just being like everybody else. So you got to find some ace in the hole that you have that would sort of elevate you above everybody else. And everybody tries to pick a specialty, whether it's being a math genius or you have a nice voice or you're like a beautiful girl. Or, you know, for me, it was being the poet because, and you know, it just took my run-of-the-mill adolescent mopiness and... instead of being mopey, I was being like melancholic, sensitive, you know. It just elevated the pedestrianness of my adolescence in my own mind. So I was more interested in the rapping than the gift.
What about being funny? Was that important too?
Yeah, sure. It was just a survival. It's just, you know, you want to stand out, you want to be different. Anybody who's a writer or a painter or anything in the arts. Is no portrait of mental health. I mean, I think one of the things above and beyond the desire to make art is this feeling of that it is intolerable to not stand out, to not be noticed, you know, and you're going to, when you're a kid, you're usually like really weird and on the edge of things and you're a lemon. And then if you become a successful artist in some way, you've learned how to make lemonade out of the lemon that you were, you know, but what the underbelly of it is I have to be an artist. I have to take this loneliness and this perimeterhood and make it work, you know, because there's no way on earth that I could be, like, undistinguished. You know, it's not a happy or a proud choice. It's a desperate choice.
There's a lot of rock and roll in your novels. Characters are always putting on records that are really important to them. What did rock and roll mean for you when you were growing up?
The same thing, well, pretty much what I said, which is escape. It's like, I'm not me, I'm Dion. I'm not me, I'm James Brown. I'm up there and I'm wearing these gold lamé tight pants with a satin cummerbund and flamenco heel shoes, and I've got 9 pounds of pomade in my hair, and I'm flipping a mic out 90 miles an hour every way to compass, and nobody has ever seen anything like this, and I'm covered with sweat, and I got a voice that could... shattered glass in another zip code, man. It, you know, and what it all boils down to is I'm not me. Thank God. Here we go. It's, you know, it's, you know, I had my ticket. I had my airplane ticket every time I put a record on.
Earlier on in our conversation, you were talking about how the characters in your novels are always thinking, this isn't it. This isn't it. Got to try something else. You know, if I'm here, I have to be there. Do you still feel that way now? Because you've, you know, you're really... getting to write really good screenplays now and working with some of the top people in the film industry, and you love movies, and you don't have to give up novels to do it. You just have to find a space to do it, but you'll be able to finance your novel because you're making so much money writing movies. Do you still feel that this isn't it?
Sure. You know, it's whatever. I mean, that's the whole point. I mean, I think there's some guy in a mountain that's just probably got a message for me, you know, if I ever get the time to go there. But whatever it is, the whole nature of it is that it ain't it. You know what I mean? It's like life is what happens to you while you're waiting for your ship to come in. You know what I mean? It has nothing to do with what you've accomplished. And I know people get irritated, like, you know, how dare you complain? How dare you say this or that? You know, it's like, you know, I work 50 hours a week lugging microwave ovens and stuff like that. You know, who the hell are you to come sit there and complain about it and not it? But I'm not talking about, like, you know, woe is me. I'm just saying that it's in the nature of life that whatever you have, it's not it, you know. I've got a family, you know, married now, which I was not married, you know, while I was writing the novels or when I started doing screenplays. I got a 9-month-old daughter who I love like crazy. I love my wife. I got, you know, a nice house. You know, I got a nice setup. But it doesn't make a difference what you have. And it's not, that's not the point. The point is that there's this itch that you can't scratch. And it's not complaining. It's just describing the nature of the human condition. You know, there's something out there with my name on it. Where is it? You know? And that's why you achieve what you achieve, is because you're looking for it. You know, and then all of a sudden you look back and you see all the stuff that you did.
Novelist and screenwriter Richard Price recorded in 1986. It's Writer's Week on Fresh Air. Here's a poem by performance poet Sekou Sindiata about how his neighborhood has changed. It's called Harlem, A Letter Home. This is from his 1997 Fresh Air interview.
It hurts me to my heart to see you like this, underworld and underweight, impossible to be with, impossible to leave. I must approach you the way I approach music sometimes, late at night and by myself, when people who can't understand are long gone, like the famous who want your infamy without your tragedy, like the rich who want your treasure without your pain. Too hard to catch up and too hard to follow, I keep looking for you anyway. Over by Harlem River Drive, where years ago you went underground, leaving two dead policemen in your trail. Then backstage at the old Apollo Theater, where we used to be waiting, pulling on the stars, begging them to kiss us like they sing. I walk around with this photograph of you at the African American Day Parade, looking like a 33rd degree Mason, an old African, a Parliament Funkadelic, an Eastern Star, a grand and flowing feather, and a Marcus Garvey hat. But in your ashy, sunken face, I see a falling of flesh from bone. I see your red eyes, your blue hands, your protruding ribs, where once I entered and lived. You were my living room, my address, and my home. What remains the same is how little, how much you've changed. You don't belong to Bird or Billy anymore. You don't belong to Malcolm or Langston anymore. And no point telling me whether you left them or they left you, since the whole thing was out of your hands. Since you have no more control over death than you do over life, but you make it and you shape it and you make it and you shape it every day. Maybe that's why you never sleep. Maybe that's why the rings around your eyes are thin lines between love and hate, that you can enter and leave at any point, the definition of a circle. Which brings you right back to where Bird plays and Billy sings, to Malcolm and Langston's words, the songs, the speeches, the poems, more alive now than them. But you're coming back is your power and your redemption. Oh, Harlem, oh, Harlem, oh, Harlem, oh, Harlem, oh, Harlem. I have searched every place, every body, every name I have ever been for you. If not your beauty, then your ugliness. If not your rhythm, then your story. Oh, Harlem, oh, Harlem, oh, Harlem. It hurts me to my heart to see you like this.
Sekou Sundiata, recorded in 1997. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Universal Pictures, presenting Snow Falling on Cedars from Scott Hicks, director of Shine, and based on the novel. Opens January 7th at theaters nationwide. And from Delacorte Press, publisher of The Change in the Weather, a look at the science of climate, written by New York Times journalist Williams K. Stevens. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, Writers Week continues. Tobias Wolff reads from his memoir, This Boy's Life, and talks about his coming of age. And Jane Rule remembers the reaction to her novel about lesbians, Desert of the Heart, published in 1964. It was later adapted into the film Desert Hearts. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This is Writers Week on Fresh Air, featuring some of our favorite interviews with writers from our archive. In 1989, I interviewed Tobias Wolff about his memoir, This Boy's Life. It was adapted into a 1993 movie, starring Leonardo DiCaprio as Wolff, Ellen Barkin as his mother, and Robert De Niro as her boyfriend. Wolff's memoir is something of a companion piece to his brother Jeffrey's acclaimed book, The Duke of Deception, a portrait of their father. Their father was a con man who fooled even his own children into believing he was from an aristocratic background. When Jeffrey and Tobias were children, their parents split up. Jeffrey lived with his father, Tobias with his mother. While Jeffrey was learning genteel manners, how to shoot and handle a boat, Tobias and his mother were virtually broke. Jeffrey's memoir is about discovering his father was a fraud. Tobias's memoir is about traveling with a loving mother who wanted to make a new life but kept getting involved with abusive men. Tobias Wolff is now a professor of English at Stanford University. Our interview started with a reading from the opening of Wolff's memoir, This Boy's Life.
Our car boiled over again just after my mother and I crossed the Continental Divide. While we were waiting for it to cool, we heard, from somewhere above us, the bawling of an air horn. The sound got louder, and then a big truck came around the corner and shot past us into the next curve, its trailer shimmying wildly. We stared after it. "Oh, Toby," my mother said. "He's lost his brakes." The sound of the horn grew distant, then faded in the wind that sighed in the trees all around us. By the time we got there, quite a few people were standing along the cliff where the truck went over. It had smashed through the guardrails and fallen hundreds of feet through empty space to the river below, where it lay on its back among the boulders. It looked pitifully small. A stream of thick black smoke rose from the cab, feathering out in the wind. My mother asked whether anyone had gone to report the accident. Someone had. We stood with the others at the cliff's edge. Nobody spoke. My mother put her arm around my shoulder. For the rest of the day, she kept looking over at me, touching me, brushing back my hair. I saw that the time was right to make a play for souvenirs. I knew she had no money for them, and I had tried not to ask, but now that her guard was down, I couldn't help myself. When we pulled out of Grand Junction, I owned a beaded Indian belt, beaded moccasins, and a bronze horse with a removable, tooled leather saddle. It was 1955, and we were driving from Florida to Utah to get away from a man my mother was afraid of and to get rich on uranium. We were going to change our luck.
One of the things I really like about that beginning is the sense of disaster can happen in any second. A trunk could just lose its brakes and go over the cliff. And your mother's going to try to be a good mother, and you're going to be a kid. I mean, it's just out of control. You're a kid. You're going to manipulate her to get that souvenir.
That's right. Yeah. It's an emblem of the book, in a way, that episode. We still talk about that episode. It made such an indelible impression on us. But
why? Why did it?
Well, we were so full of hope and going to this new life, and just for a moment there, we were too foolish for our optimism ever to get dampened for long, but just for a moment there, we tasted it, you know. We tasted our mortality, and we tasted the vanity of our hopes, seeing this man who probably was very hopeful himself about getting home for dinner that night, finishing his run, suddenly have everything go wrong on him. And I've never forgotten it. I can still see his face in the windshield.
You talked about how this memoir for you is really about coming of age, finding out who you are, who you want to be, and trying to become that. Your father transformed himself through lying, through making up a false history, through making up lineage that he didn't have, through even lying about his furniture and where that came from, making things into antiques that weren't.
Right.
Your mother wanted to transform herself and wanted to change her luck, but the way she ended up actually taking action was to hook up with different men.
Yes.
And all of those men ended up being disasters. They abused both your mother and you. And she seemed to really be unaware that that was going to happen each time she'd meet a new man. But you seemed to always know.
No, I didn't always know this was going to happen until it happened. I in a sense, conspired in this by not by not learning my lesson either. We went from one man like this to another. It's true. But I think that what's more important than this is what we made of these situations. I mean, it's true that we drifted into these rather violent and frightening situations sometimes together, but we always kept faith with each other, and we kept our pluck, and we changed our luck again and again. We reinvented the circumstances. We'd go somewhere else and try again, and eventually, oddly enough, we were right. It worked. We both translated ourselves to different people and to better lives.
When you were young and you were in the Boy Scouts, you'd like to really read the Boy Scouts magazine, Boy's Life.
Mm-hmm.
Why did that really appeal to you? Your life was very different from the kind of mainstream view of what a Boy Scout should be, the good and healthy, wholesome life.
Yeah, that's right. I think that when I was reading it, I fell into a kind of spell in which I believed I was those boys that the magazine was about, these boys who saved lives and had trap lines in the Arctic, and boys who built airplanes in their backyards and flew them at state fairs, these extraordinary young entrepreneurs. And while I was reading this magazine, I felt like I was participating in this ideal American boyhood that all the movies I went to and the television shows and the radio shows that I listened to sort of invited us all to believe we were living. Yeah, so that magazine was very, very important to me in that way when I was young. That's why I called this memoir of mine This Boy's Life. It's to distinguish between that ideal boyhood of the, you know, of Norman Rockwell, the kind of pictures that Norman Rockwell would draw of young of childhood, and the kind that I and in fact most of the boys I knew when I was growing up actually lived.
You really wanted to have a conventional life and a conventional family.
Sure. Sure. I think it's a real cycle. I think that children who grow up in safe, secure, conventional, middle-class families all want to become outlaws and
right.
rebels and live in dirty apartments and never do the dishes. And children who grow up chaotically and in poverty and who have no automatic hold on respectability in the world come to prize conventionality and security. Yes, that's what I wanted when I don't want it so much anymore, I think, but I sure did want it when I was a boy.
Your mother wanted a good family that spent time together also, and I really like what you write about that. You say, Mother insisted we spend time together like a real family. Our failure was ordained because the real family we set out to imitate doesn't exist in nature. A real family as troubled as ours would never dream of spending time together.
That's right. Yeah, I'd forgotten that line. That's right.
But how much of that charade did you go through?
Well, we had our rich. This was the life I led with my first stepfather and his family, and that we led with them. And we did. We had these rituals of family life, and they were they gave us for a little while the appearance, and we actually probably believed that we were a real family when we would sit together and watch Lawrence Welk. I can't think hear the name today without wilting. Mitch something in the sing-along
Mitch
gang.
Mitch Miller.
He used to make us watch Mitch Miller. We'd all sit around. That was our idea of a family evening, is sitting in front of the tube and watching Lawrence Welk and Mitch Miller. And my stepfather would get his old saxophone out and sit there oh, Lord. Don't make me relive it again.
I don't know. You've just been through it in your book, although you left out that particular story.
The Mitch Miller one I left out, but I've got Lawrence Welk in there all right.
Your memoir, This Boy's Life, is about how you invented and reinvented yourself, and perhaps the most stunning reinvention of yourself that you're responsible for is how you got into prep school. Just to explain here, although your father had for a while been rich, your mother, who you were with, was always poor. And when you were in, I guess it was junior high school, you and your brother started communicating, and your brother urged you to try to get away from your father, your stepfather, who was beating you, and try to get into prep school. And he said he'd try to help you. So you got really hooked on the idea and tried to get a scholarship. So what you did was you made up letters of recommendations from all of your teachers, and you tried to really write it in their tone of voice.
And you wrote, "And on the boy who lived in their letters, the splendid phantom who carried all my hopes, it seemed to me at last I saw my own face." And I thought that's so convincing that you were really, truly writing letters about the boy who you think you were or deserved to be as a boy, as opposed to the boy who you were forced to become.
Right. Yeah. Well, we all have a kind of dream self.
Mm-hmm.
And in making, in writing those, my actual self, I'm afraid, wasn't quite the boy that I portrayed in those letters. I was a very indifferent student in a very bad school. I hung out with a bad bunch, and I mean, they were actually good guys, really, looking back on it, but they were considered a bad bunch then. And I was no model of American boyhood. And to get into this, I had to get a scholarship to this prep school, and it was quite clear to me that being the boy I was, in fact, was not going to get me in. I couldn't even get a letter of recommendation from my teachers, so I decided to take this task on myself. What did I have to lose, right? I'd end up, if I lost, being where I was. So I basically wrote down in these letters of recommendation that I made up a picture of the boy that I dreamed I really was if everybody just knew me actually, as well as I knew myself. And you know, the straight-A student, the Eagle Scout, upright fellow, and manufactured this identity and did it, I guess, persuasively enough, since I did get it, a scholarship to a fine prep school, which changed my life completely.
Did you do a convincing job of reinventing yourself at prep school because you had to pretend to be the boy who you had described in these letters, the boy who got you into this school?
No, it didn't hold up very well. For one thing, coming from such a lousy school as I was coming from, and not having been a good student at that school anyway, I didn't know very much. I was very ignorant, and my teachers were puzzled at how little I knew considering the brilliant transcripts that came in. I had a friend in the school office at that school who gave me the school transcript form, so I made out my own grades, and I awarded myself straight A's and in courses that I hadn't even taken in order to get in. So I didn't know very much. I had a terrible time academically at the school, but an English teacher there took me under his wing and tutored me and gave me books, and I was excited about reading anyway, but he taught me to be a systematic and careful reader, and he excited me about writing, as indeed my brother had also, and really brought me along. It was the pivotal experience of my life being at that school and being under that man's tutelage, and I owe, you know, just all kinds of things to him for that. So it turned out to be a wonderful, almost fairy tale escape for me, and I loved the school. But no, the act didn't hold up, and eventually it fell apart, and I was, in my senior year there, in my last year, my sixth form year, I was asked to leave.
We're listening to a 1989 interview with Tobias Wolff. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1989 interview with Tobias Wolff, recorded after the publication of his memoir, This Boy's Life. Tobias Wolff, we were just talking about how you lied your way into prep school but eventually got thrown out. Do you believe in lying when it's the only way to get what you need and when you know that ultimately you're not telling a terrible mistruth, that it won't be a malicious mistruth?
Well, on the one hand, as a writer, I'm committed to truth. I mean, in this book about a boy who lies, I am very scrupulous in telling the truth, and the book is in a lot of ways about the cost of not telling the truth. So no, ultimately, I think lies subtract from your substance as a person, and the more of them you tell, the more you beggar yourself. But I will distinguish between lying and invention, and especially self-invention. Children need to try on different selves. They don't know who they are. They try different things. You'll see the way kids change their hair constantly, you know, their hairdos, and experiment with their clothes and all that. It's really all sort of fumbling around trying to figure out who they are. And And so there's a period when you're young when I think especially parents have to be very careful not to apply standards about lying to what is naturally occurring in the child's life in terms of just figuring out who they are and trying on different selves. And sometimes that involves acts of self-invention. And I think that, you know, that we have to be very tolerant about that.
Even when you're trying very hard to tell the truth, there are so many different versions of the truth. Did you run into that when writing this memoir? I think you gave the manuscript to your mother and to your brother and to others to read before
yes,
it was published.
Absolutely. Yeah. I wanted to be sure that when it came out, they wouldn't say, oh, no, this is, I mean, not to others, but to me, you got it all wrong. And I was very gratified that they were very impressed by the accuracy of the record and that it really squared with their own recollections. My mother had some questions about chronology. She has a wonderful kind of memory, and she says here and there I got things switched around and whatnot, but nothing serious at all. And basically I let those things stand because that's the way I remembered them, and that's the story I'm telling is what my memory tells me. You can follow someone around with a camera and a notebook and a tape recorder, and you'll get a lot of facts, but you won't get the truth. The truth lies in the memory, and because that's the story you tell yourself about who you are and where you come from, where you've been. And so I was very attentive to my memory and trusted that.
You and your brother have both written memoirs about your childhood. You've read each other's books, and you've become very close over the years, even though you were separated from each other during childhood.
Maybe that's why we're close.
Did you ever go through a period of envying each other's lives? Did you ever wish you'd stayed with your father? Did your father ever wish he'd stayed with your mother? Did he ever wish he was poor, like you were often poor? Did you ever wish that you had money like he did?
I can't speak for him. I don't think that he ever wished to be poor. I don't think anybody ever wished to be poor. But I certainly spent a lot of time wishing I was rich. And my father was a very charismatic guy. Though I hardly knew him, I remembered him well. I could remember the sort of tobacco smell that used to cling to his tweeds. He had a deep, grumbling voice, and he was big and had a very bearish kind of presence. And I remember lying in my bed at night and hearing his voice come through the bedroom wall, that rumble of his, and I'd how secure I'd feel hearing that. So there were, you know, I longed to be with my father, not to be with my mother, but to be with my father also. And I romanticized him and idealized him.
We were talking about lies before. What was the most damaging lie that your father told you?
It wasn't so much lies he told me, but truths that he did not tell me. I was led to believe by him that we came from an aristocratic family, and that... he had coats of arms and all this, and my mother was Irish Catholic. I was brought up in the Catholic Church, and he objected to this. He said his family had always been Episcopalians and everything. Well, it turned out my father's family were a wonderful Jewish family of doctors and brilliant surgeons with their own claim to respect and stature, which he and some... He didn't want to be Jewish, and he cut my brother and I off not only from that knowledge, but from the knowledge of that of his wonderful family, because he didn't want us to understand this about him, and consequently about ourselves. And so we lost that half of our family. When my brother went back to write about my father and interviewed these people, they were wonderful people. And it broke our hearts that we had been denied their company when we were growing up and the richness of that life that they had in Hartford. So, you know, his lies had terrible, terrible consequences on us, as his absence did on me. That's partly what this book is about. I don't romanticize lying in this book. I talk about self-invention. I talk about lies, and the lies, you know, the big lies in this book cause inestimable harm.
Tobias Wolff recorded in 1989 after the publication of his memoir, This Boy's Life. Coming up, Jane Rule on writing lesbian fiction in the 60s. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. Our Writers' Week continues with our interview with Jane Rule. In 1964, at a time when few writers dared to address the subject of homosexuality, Jane Rule published her first novel, Desert of the Heart. The main character was a woman who, after divorcing her husband, fell in love with another woman. The book was adapted into the 1985 movie Desert Hearts. Rule has written about lesbian themes in subsequent novels, short stories, and essays. Rule was born in New Jersey and has lived in Vancouver, Canada, since 1956. I spoke with her in 1988 after the publication of her novel Memory Board about two women in their 60s. I asked her if she was out among her friends and colleagues in 1964 when her novel Desert of the Heart was published.
Not officially. You have to remember that in those days you didn't talk about things like that. Certainly among my friends and my family I was, but I was teaching at the University of British Columbia at the time, and someone did bring up the issue after the book came out. And the defense in the department was, you don't have to be a murderer to write murder mysteries. And I think this is a very silly defensiveness, but in 1964, not surprising.
The stakes were really much higher then. There was no gay and lesbian movement. The stakes were much higher, I think, to admit to yourself or to anyone else that you were gay.
Well, it's not very hard to admit if you're in a very happy relationship. In fact, it's something to celebrate, so that it didn't seem to me anything humiliating, just awkwardly private. So that there were social problems about it. You know, we kept being invited to dinner parties with two gay men so that it would all look all right. And it was a totally open secret. But, I mean, you simply dealt in those terms in those days. I got much more restless much earlier than most people, I suppose, and then found myself the only open lesbian in Canada. And therefore, anytime an issue came up, I had to address it. So I became a kind of spokesperson for no movement because there wasn't anybody else out there.
Well, you once said that you hate labels that are used to describe writers. You know, women writer, feminist writer, lesbian writer. But if a label had to be applied to you, you'd like it to be Canadian writer. Why do you feel so strongly about that? And what got you to Canada?
Well, what got me to Canada was discovering Vancouver, which is one of the most beautiful cities in the world. And so it was actually the landscape. But also, I was looking for a way to get out of the United States. And you may not remember, but in the 1950s, McCarthy was requiring loyalty oaths and hunting down homosexuals all across the country and universities and the army. It was a very ugly, ugly time in the United States.
Although the movement, the feminist movement and the gay and lesbian movement, has had a lot of really positive effects for you, I think that there... One disadvantage that you've cited is the emphasis on political correctness, which you've always taken issue with.
In a sense, being a writer of fiction, I'm strongly opposed to fiction being used as propaganda for any reason. However, I think that if you present any characters, gay characters, positively, you're accused of propaganda because the spoken and agreed on cliche is that all gay people are sick and miserable. But really, that one line that I must write all my characters to be perfect if they're gay that comes out of the gay movement is as silly. We aren't. We come in all different stripes as everyone else does.
I would suspect that your readers write you very emotional letters. I'm thinking especially of readers who were first coming out as they started reading you, and it's so exciting to find characters in fiction whose lives reflect in some way your life, and gays have been so marginalized, especially in the past, in our culture, that it's just been impossible to find images of people who were gay. And if you find it, it can be so exciting. So I'm sure you've gotten very personal letters from readers who really wanted to make some kind of emotional contact with you. But it's really hard for an author to pay back emotionally, you know, in the same way that a reader would write in. How have you handled that?
I think it was most difficult for me when Desert of the Heart came out, because, of course, that was a little book out there all by itself without any other books for people to turn to. When you get a letter from a distressed reader or a reader who feels you're the only person in the whole world who understands them, there really isn't very much you can do. You know, when someone is writing you from South America saying they're about to kill themselves and only you can help, it's horrifying. And I think that it was the greatest burden to me after that book came out. I don't get as many distressed letters anymore. I get many more happy, celebrating letters, which are much easier to deal with.
When you were young, did you look for literature that had some evidence of homosexuality in it?
No. I read The Well of Loneliness when I was a kid and was horrified by it.
What horrified you?
Well, I thought, I'm going to have to live in a ghetto and dress up like a man. And I was already 6 feet tall with a deep voice, so you know, it was just... And I couldn't speak French, and apparently the only people who knew each other were people who lived in Paris, and the whole thing just turned me off completely. And there was nothing else. But I didn't really look in literature for much of anything. I really, when I was a kid, thought that novels did an awful lot of lying about how people really felt. I didn't really understand that they were making social comments. I mean, I knew perfectly well that children didn't die so that we would be better people, as they do in Dickens, and I was very suspicious of literature, perhaps because I didn't find people or feelings that I could much identify with.
Well, then what made you want to write?
To tell the truth. Somebody had to.
Well, Jane Rule, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your life and your writing.
Thank you. It's been a lovely interview.
Jane Rule, recorded in 1988. Our Writers' Week series continues tomorrow on Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our Writers' Week series is produced by Kathy Wolfe. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Patty Leswing. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, publisher of Snow Crash by Neal Stephenson. Snow Crash, presenting in America at the time we are now entering, with Stephenson's cyber sensibility. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, our Writers' Week series continues with interviews from the archives with writers who are no longer with us, including James Baldwin, poet Jane Kenyon, and Paul Monette, who wrote about AIDS. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.